You are listening to the teaching ministry of Bay Ridge Christian Church. The following teaching is given by one of the missionaries that our church supports. Jesus has called the church to go into all the world and proclaim the good news, and our support for missions is an important part of fulfilling the Great Commission. We hope you enjoy this teaching and are encouraged to participate in the great task of taking the gospel to all people. For more teachings and resources, or to learn more about the missions work that Bay Ridge supports, please go to bayridgechristianchurch.org.
This morning, we're going to have a bit of a special treat. Those of you who are here regularly know, normally you would hear me be beginning to say, "Hear the words of our covenant Lord," or something like that. This morning, it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to be getting to hear from Bill Ardill, who's going to be sharing with us about the work that they've been doing in Nigeria. We were talking the other day. I was trying to remember how long it had been since their son David was born, because we were involved when they got medevaced back here, and it was longer than I'd remembered. I didn't realize it had been quite so long ago. We've also been involved with Bill and Dorothy when Bill got shot. Not to bring up all these difficult things, but we've seen them working for a long, long time in the work they've been doing over there in Nigeria. I guess we've been supporting y'all now for 12, 13, 14 years, something like that. Yeah. So it's been a long-term relationship, and we're really, really excited about it. As all of you know, they're kind of going through a transition time now and what God's called them to do. And so Bill's going to be sharing all this with us, and then they will be with us for a while at the picnic. So I just want to go ahead and turn it over to Bill, encourage you to give your attention. At the end, we're going to have a chance to give to them in a love offering, and then also to be able to come forward and pray for them and just ask God to be with them and watch over them. It is a major, major transition they're going through. If you've ever talked with missionaries very much, I mean, they've been living in a different world from us for a long time. It's going to be a big adjustment for them and the family as they're coming back here, so we really want to pray for them. So I'll turn it over to Bill, and okay, thanks for being here.
Good morning. I have three purposes this morning, so if you're taking notes, here are the 3 points of my message. First of all, I want to declare the faithfulness of God to us over many years of service overseas, and I'll explain a little bit about what that means. And I want to thank you for your faithfulness in praying for us and supporting us through some good times and some tough times. And so I want to publicly thank you for your faithfulness. I know you pray for us, you talk about us, you write to us, and all kinds of ways encourage us. So thank you very much, and I want to make sure that I begin by expressing our deep appreciation for what you have meant to us in our ministry overseas. And the third thing I want to do is to give you a little bit of an update about what we've been doing and the situation in Nigeria, and to help you maybe understand a little bit more how to pray for missionaries, especially those that are working in Muslim areas where there is a lot of tension today. Just to give you some information about who we are, some of you may not know who we are. We are serving with an organization called SIM, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dorothy and I served in Liberia for 4 years, from 1986 to 1990. And then because of the civil war there, initiated by Charles Taylor, you may have heard that name, he has just been given 50 years sentence for his war crimes during that conflict. So we were in Liberia for 4 years and then were evacuated because of the civil war, and then went to Nigeria in 1992. So we have been serving in Nigeria at a place called Jos since 1992, and Bay Ridge has been involved in supporting us for most of that time that we have been in Nigeria, the last 20 years. We have 4 children. My oldest daughter, Marie, is finishing her 3rd year at Azusa Pacific University. She is right now in Spain, working in a ministry actually very similar to what you're talking about, working with girls who have been abused and girls that have been through difficult relationships. Marie is interested in child psychology and helping children that have been through trauma. So she spent this semester in Chile, in Santiago, working in an orphanage there, and then came to visit us in Nigeria for the month of May, helped us pack the house and say goodbye. And then when we were in London, we came on to Baltimore and she peeled off to Madrid. And now she's in Spain for this month, working in 2 different ministries there, working with children. So she'll be joining us sometime this summer, and really look forward to that. The next in line are the twins, Heather and Anna. They have just finished high school at the mission school where we live, Hillcrest School. If you could think of two entirely different careers, I'm a physician, right? I'm a surgeon. So my daughter Heather has decided to go on into a pre-med program at Azusa Pacific, and she's excited about starting that in the fall. Now, if you could think of something completely opposite to medicine, what would come to your mind? How about fashion design? That's about as far away as you can get from medicine. So Anna's going into fashion design, not to spite me, but because she's very gifted in art and fashion. It's been wonderful to see how the Lord has allowed that gift in her to emerge over the last 2 years. So she'll be going to Seattle Pacific University up in Seattle and be starting a program there in fashion design. So we're excited to see how the Lord leads her in that industry. I don't know how much you know about the fashion industry, but it sounds like to me there are a lot of strange people in that industry, you know? But the chairman of the department up at Seattle University, Seattle Pacific, it's a Christian school, when she was talking to us and trying to help allay my fears about my daughter diving into the deep end of secularism, she said, "Bill, just look around the room. I mean, you look around the room here." She said, "Everybody has clothes on. Most of you all have clothes on, right? I haven't seen any naked people walk in, right? Well, you buy your clothes from somewhere. Somebody's designing those clothes. Somebody's making those clothes. Somebody's buying the material for those clothes. So Anna will never be out of work because most people wear clothes in the world today. So that kind of helped allay my fears that she's employable if she has a career in fashion design. And I think she really has a heart for ministry and being a light in a very dark corner of the industry. There are a lot of people that need to hear about Jesus, and she really has a passion for sharing Christ through the gifts that God has given her in that area. So that's what Anna's going to do. And then our fourth is David, and he's with us today. He's almost 12, born here at Anne Arundel Medical Center, and David is going to be the only one at home with us this year. From here, we are beginning tomorrow morning our pilgrimage across the United States. From here, we drive up to upstate New York tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, I fly to California for 2 weeks and then fly back. And then we, after a couple weeks, we head to Grand Rapids and then Chicago and then Dallas and Tyler and San Antonio and Colorado Springs and Jackson, Wyoming, and then finally Utah and San Diego. So that's our plan for the summer. So we are looking forward, actually, to visiting lots of friends and churches like you guys who have been praying for us and interested in what we've been doing. So we're looking forward to this See America trip because it gives us an opportunity to see good friends that we know love us and pray for us. And then we plan to settle in Southern California and San Diego in August and rethink this change in our lives. We believe for several reasons. The Lord is closing the chapter of Nigeria in our lives. There are some reasons why we think it's important to leave Nigeria at this time. And there are some important reasons why we think we need to be here in the U.S. to be close to my three daughters in college and my parents and some other things. So this is quite a change for us. I was born in Jos, grew up in Jos, and went back to Jos and have been there the last 20 years. So it's going to be quite a change for us in terms of our identity and our ministry, and we're excited to see what God has for us in that pagan mission field called California. There are some strange people out there too that need Jesus. So we'll see what God has for us. December 24th, 2010. December 24th, that's Christmas Eve. Our world changed in Nigeria. We've been through lots of different crises and all kinds of things have come up, but December 24th, 2010 was a remarkable day. Christmas Eve, 7:30 at night, the markets were full. People were, you know, buying last-minute things and trying to figure out what they were going to get, and so the markets were packed with people doing their last-minute shopping. Five men walked into the market with wheelbarrows full of explosives and detonated those explosives in the middle of the market. That changed our world in Jos, because that was the beginning of terrorism as we'd never seen it before in our part of the world. Those men were associated with an organization called Boko Haram, and it is a radical Islamic sect that is growing rapidly in Nigeria, supported by Al-Qaeda. And if you follow the news, you know that they are wreaking havoc throughout Nigeria. It changed the way we think, it changed the way we live, it changed the way we move, it changed everything in our area of the world, because what we had been used to was a more traditional tribalism and conflict between Christians and Muslims, but it was more moderates and it was much less attacking innocent people as attacking people that they thought as their tribal enemies. The conflict in many areas of the world, you will learn, is not as simplistic as the U.S. State Department would make it look. In Nigeria, there are about four levels of conflict. At the local level, there is the conflict between indigenous tribes. In our area, there are three indigenous tribes, and then there are people from outside who have come to live in the land. Well, tribalism is such an important part of life in Africa that you are almost unemployable by the government if you are not an indigent of that area. You also are not electable if you are not an indigent. So you can imagine what that does to the political scene if the indigents hold that much power over the political process. Well, most tribes are also associated with a religious group. And in Nigeria, if you're not a Muslim, you're a Christian. You understand that? If you're not a Muslim, you're a Christian. So it's a cultural definition. And during times of unrest and civil conflict, they would set up checkpoints around the city. And on the Muslim side of town, there would be Muslim gangs, right? And if you went through, tried to get through that area, if you couldn't say the creed in Arabic, there is one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. If you couldn't say that in Arabic, then you were clearly not a Muslim and they would take you and shoot you. If you were on the Christian side of town and you came to the Christian gangs and the Christian youth and you couldn't say John 3:16, they would assume you were not a Christian and then they would deal with you too. So there's that kind of polarization at a tribal level, at a religious level, and that's kind of what we've been used to, okay? Several years ago, 2 years ago, there was major political rioting in the town, and it got to the point where now there is this invisible wall right down the middle of our city along the Bauchi Road. And to the north of the Bauchi Road, it is Muslim. To the south of the Bauchi Road is Christian. If the Muslims cross the road and go into the Christian area, the Christians will kill them. And if the Christians go into the Muslim part of town, the Muslims will kill them. That's the world that we now live in. So there are parts of our city that I haven't gone into in 2 or 3 years because I've been told if I go in there and there's any kind of problem, they will kill me. So our city has settled into this discrimination and this polarized town that we've kind of gotten used to as the new norm, believe it or not. So I just know that if I want to get from here to there, it's kind of like the Jews and Samaria. If you remember, I'm sure your pastor has told you about the problem of the Jews from Jerusalem trying to get up to Galilee. They wouldn't go through Samaria, so they had to go around to get up to Galilee because Samaria was considered an area that was unclean. Well, the same is true in our city. If I want to get from here to the back of the auditorium, I can't go through the Muslim part of town. I've got to go way around the Christian side to get over there. And that's the kind of polarization that Islam is causing, as well as the Christians, as they're trying to figure out how to respond. So that's the norm until December 24th, 2010, when this outside group then came in, and Boko Haram, funded by Al-Qaeda, now have become the new force to reckon with because they are attacking everybody. They're attacking their own Muslims. If you're not radical enough, they will attack you. Their headquarters is up in the northeast part of Nigeria, a place called Maiduguri, and they have been bombing schools and mosques, police headquarters, the press. They bomb anybody. that doesn't agree with them and doesn't support a radical Islam that would implement a much more radical of version of Sharia law than there is in northern Nigeria today. What happened in the last 2 years is that this group has been specifically targeting churches and government buildings. So in our city, they've attacked about 5 different churches. So you could imagine on a Sunday morning, somebody would come and very easily in your church, they could drive a car right through the front door and a suicide bomber would drive a car in here and explode it. And that's what we deal with. And that's happened to at least 5 different churches in our city and has created tremendous concern. Thank you, David. How do you protect yourself against that? And how do you respond to that? And the church in Nigeria is wrestling with those issues. The first issue is actually much easier to respond to. How do you deal with that kind of threat? And so now in our city on Sunday morning, you can't drive by a church. So the road out here, is this Forest Avenue or something like that, the main road here? See, that would be blocked off on the lane coming into the church. So there'd be no traffic at all. All the motorcycles would have to walk and the cars would have to take the outside lane to allow them to pass. So every single church in our city now, there's no traffic in front of any church on a Sunday morning for 4 hours. So the city comes to a standstill on Sunday morning to try to keep the suicide bombers from threatening the churches. They've also put barricades. So at our school, Hillcrest School, which is a Christian mission school, we have had to set up barricades and booms and zigzags and concrete walls and all kinds of things to reduce the risk of somebody coming in. So, for example, in your foyer or your outside porch there, you would have concrete pillars there to prevent a vehicle from getting in, and you would actually stop any traffic from coming by the front of the car, front of the building. So we've had to do that in every public building, and every church now has tried to reduce the threat of a bomb because they are now targeting just about anybody. That's the easy part, actually. The harder part is, how would you as a Christian respond to people that are innocently doing those kinds of terrorist acts? How would you respond? You see, in the past, we were actually quite appalled that the Christians were responding in kind. And when it was at the tribal warfare level, where the Christians in the tribes were responding to the Muslims and their tribes, at the tribal level, the Christians were retaliating, and in some cases going on the offensive and attacking Muslim parts of town. And they would burn the Muslim part of town to the ground and kill all the Muslims in that area. That's what the Christians are doing. And it was very alarming to us to watch and say, is that really how the church should be responding to this kind of threat? You know, it's difficult when your home is threatened, your church is threatened, and there's that kind of violence. Since the escalation from tribalism to terrorism, we have been amazed that the church has not responded with violence. In fact, the church has done nothing except harden the church barrier, harden the perimeters, and do all the security measures. Instead, the churches are praying like crazy. It is really phenomenal. And if you talk to Nigerian Christians today and you say, well, what do you think about Boko Haram? Aren't you afraid? And they say, God is in control. God is in control. God is going to deal with these people. So we're not sure what God is trying to do through this process. And as you look back over history and you see areas of the world where the church has been persecuted, you know, God allows that for a reason, just like he allows us to go through persecution and suffering in our own lives. And I don't know the reasons, but I know some of the reasons. If you remember the story of what happened in China, God used the communists to purify the church in China so that now the church in China today, even though it's oppressed, is strong and pure and faithful to God. And God somehow used the persecution and the blood of his saints to grow the church in China. And I don't know if God is maybe using Islam to purify the church in Africa. Because one of the problems in the church in Africa is that it's very self-centered, and the prosperity gospel has taken a deep root in Africa to the point where they don't care about people outside of their own flock. They don't really care about reaching the lost. They don't really care about the Muslim world. They just care about themselves. And so we're wondering if maybe God is using Islam as a tool, the way he used the Assyrians and the Babylonians to help deal with Israel. Maybe God is using it to help clarify for the church their mission in the world, which is to declare his glory to all the nations. So as you hear news, and Nigeria will continue to come up on the news, I guarantee this isn't over yet. This threat is also extended into Niger and into Burkina Faso and into Mali and other areas of West Africa where there is tension between Muslims and Christians. And the church is trying to figure out how do we respond and what do we do? And I think it's actually helping the church clarify its mission and helping the church understand that these people need Jesus more than anything. It's not a matter of education. It's not a matter of poverty. People blame poverty and education and lack of education on all kinds of things, you know? But the root problem is that they don't know the Lord. And they don't have the peace that God gives. And I think the church is the only answer to that by sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. So when you think of Nigeria and you think of Niger and other countries where I know the church has an interest, pray for not just the missionaries that are there, but pray for the Christians that they will learn how to respond as Christ would respond. Because it's tough. If you had your church blown up, what would you do? Go to the government? Well, the government is infiltrated with Boko Haram. Would you go to the army? Well, the army is infiltrated with Boko Haram. Would you go to the police? Well, the police is the most corrupt institution in Nigeria. So you don't have too many places to go except to God. And so what the churches are doing is they're rebuilding and they're getting stronger and they're defending themselves the best they can. And the churches are continuing to do what they're supposed to do, is to proclaim the glory of God. So that's the world that we just came out of a week ago. You can imagine the stress is quite high. I was the chairman of the board of the school and chair of the security committee, and we were very close to closing the school permanently because we had specific bomb threats against the school. How would you respond if there was a bomb threat against the school? What do you do? These people are serious. They drive by with a motorbike and chuck the bomb from the motorbike and blow up a bunch of kids. I mean, that's what they do. So it's something that's difficult and very sobering. And that's what we have just come out of. And so we ask you to continue to pray for missionaries that are serving in those kinds of areas like Pakistan and other areas in the Middle East and now in Africa, where radical Islam is starting to have a huge influence and has infiltrated not just at the local level, but at very high levels in the government. I was at down in the capital city about a month ago for another engagement and was talking to a man who is a high in the Nigerian army, at one of the, I guess he would be in the inner circle of the president. And he said that when the president of Nigeria calls together his top military advisors to talk about security strategy, within 1 hour of that meeting, Boko Haram knows what they talked about. So they have people that are at very high levels of the government that are working against the government to destabilize it. So how do you pray? Well, you pray that God will somehow give wisdom to the Christians that are in leadership and courage to believers to stand up for what's right and not retaliate with violence or in kind, but to show them the love of Christ. Let me change from the message of doom and despair to something a little more positive that I'm excited about to report to you. A number of years ago, when we went to Nigeria, as a physician, I was quite discouraged that there were quite a number of women coming to the hospital who had had abortions by local people and had complications from their abortions. Well, we would patch these women up and do the best we could. Some of them survived, some of them didn't survive because they had had such difficult problems. And then we had women that would come and say, we would like you to do our abortion. I need an abortion and I would like you to do it because I know you're a good surgeon and you're going to do a good job. So can you do my abortion? Well, how do you handle that? I don't want to do the abortion. I mean, for obvious biblical reasons, but I know if I say no, she's just going to go down the street and find somebody that will. So we were very frustrated by that problem for a number of years. And finally, the Lord kind of put it on my heart to say, you guys got to do something, you know? This is not a real difficult problem to solve. There are people that know how to do this. So when we were here in Annapolis about 7 years ago, we stopped in at one of the local crisis pregnancy centers here in town, and we walked in and said, we want to learn how to do this. We're Christians, we're missionaries, and we want to know how to start a crisis pregnancy center in Africa. And so they spent an hour with us and gave us all the brochures and kind of walked us through it. And we went back to Nigeria, and Joss, we got together and decided, let's try to do something. So we called a meeting and just announced that we were going to have a meeting about a crisis pregnancy possibility. And at the first meeting, 70 Nigerians showed up from our hospital staff. We were just amazed. And they said, we know this is a huge problem, but we don't know what to do, and we want your help. So that was the beginning of what has now become a wonderful ministry to help women that are in crisis pregnancies. And that ministry has grown and grown. We've trained counselors, and we've been able to help many, many women through the difficulty of what do you do in a situation where you have an unwanted pregnancy for all kinds of reasons. In some cases, they were forced. In some cases, it was incestuous relationships. In some cases, it was kids that were involved in a relationship and they didn't want the baby. They were in school. So through that crisis pregnancy ministry, it's been wonderful for me now to drive around the city of Joss, and I can see a little girl there and a little boy there, and a little boy there that I know is alive today because of the crisis pregnancy ministry. And you all are part of that because you helped us and encouraged us and supported us through that. My daughters just graduated 2 weeks ago from the high school, and as we were practicing for the graduation ceremony and learning how to walk up and down the aisle and all that usual stuff with pomp and circumstances. At the end of the graduation practice, a missionary woman came up to me and she gave me a manila envelope and she said, Bill, I think you'd like this. I said, okay, I didn't know what it was. So she took off and after the practice, I opened that envelope and in that envelope was a beautiful picture of a little Nigerian girl. 5-year-old girl. Her name is Lily. And Lily was one of the first babies that we rescued through the crisis pregnancy ministry. And Mary Beth and her husband have adopted Lily, and now she's part of their family. That was just about the best gift I ever got in my whole life, the picture of Lily, to remind me to continue to pray for those women in trouble and for the crisis pregnancy ministry at the hospital that continues to help girls in crisis. We have had pastors, believe it or not, pastors come in with their daughters and they say, my daughter's pregnant and she's embarrassing me. I'm a pastor. She's an embarrassment. Can you do an abortion? We need to get rid of the problem. So it's really provided us a great opportunity to reach pastors and churches and people that don't know that there is an alternative and there is hope and there is an opportunity through that crisis to draw the family together, to bring reconciliation, to have a better understanding of the sanctity of life from the biblical standpoint. And if they can't raise that child, we have a long list of people that are wanting to raise a child. Couples that have been looking for a child and can't have a child. And so we've had the joy of being able to place these babies in homes where they're loved like you wouldn't believe. So it's been wonderful. And as I left, one of the hardest things was to say goodbye to my friends in the crisis pregnancy ministry. And it's all nationalized. There aren't any missionaries involved. The Nigerians are taking it. They've caught the vision and they're running with it and doing a wonderful job in proclaiming through schools and boys' brigade and girls' brigade and youth groups and churches the whole message of the importance of sexual purity and the importance of the sanctity of life, that if there is a situation where there is a pregnancy that's unwanted, that there are alternatives, and there are ways in which God can somehow help you through that and still keep that little baby alive. So that's a good story, and it's a story that I look back on with great memories and thank the Lord for allowing us to begin that kind of ministry. The other two things that I want to talk about are two things that my wife has been involved in, just to share a little bit about some of the things that she's been involved in that we've sort of done together. A number of years ago, after Dorothy was involved in the hospital for a little while, she felt the Lord was leading her into working with women and patients, people that were living with AIDS, so HIV-positive people and their families, to try to help them. Our hospital had a counseling service, and they also had a community outreach program trying to help educate people on how to live and take care of people that were HIV-positive. Through that process, she discovered that in the church, the little Nigerian church next to the hospital, there was a women's fellowship group. Now, I think most pastors would agree that the women's groups in the churches are the backbone of the church, right? They pray the most, they give the most, they're the most committed people, right? I hear an amen over there. Okay. It's wonderful. And in the Nigerian churches, it is absolutely remarkable how well organized the women's fellowship groups are. If you want to get anything done in the church in Africa, go to the women. Go to the women. And so as Dorothy became part of the women's fellowship and began to learn how well organized they were and how concerned they were, she asked them a simple question: how many widows do you have in the church? Well, they actually didn't know. And so as they began looking around the place in this women's fellowship group of 300 women, they discovered they had about 20 widows. Some women they didn't know were widows, and some they discovered had orphans that were taking care of each other. So there was the widow population, and then there was the orphan group, and the women's fellowship were amazed at how many there were among them. And a number of the widows were widows because their husbands were HIV positive and died of AIDS and never told their wife. Some women get sick and discover they're HIV positive, and that's when they discovered that their husband died because he was HIV positive and he infected them. So there was a huge opportunity and need for education of women about AIDS and how not to get AIDS, and what do you do with somebody who's positive, and then what do you do with all these orphans and the widows in the church? Well, if you go to a women's fellowship meeting, they have about 5 offerings. Right? You think it's bad here. Where do you get to Africa? Okay? So they keep taking the offerings, and they take an offering for this, an offering for the bus, and an offering for this, and an offering for that. So Dorothy thought, you know, there's no way that we're going to be able to actually do another offering. And so the Lord gave her this idea that she'd heard about from some other place. And so we bought about 300 little clear plastic buckets, about that big. And this was the idea. We gave to the 300 women in the women's fellowship, we gave each woman a bucket. And we said, every time you cook, and most of them would cook a single grain, they would live on corn or maize or rice, take a handful of that grain and put it in the bucket. And at the end of the month, we're all going to bring our buckets together and dump the grain in the front of the church. So we'll start collecting grains to help the widows and the orphans in the church. I thought, that's a pretty simple idea. It only cost us the cost of the buckets. The women, it didn't cost them much anything because they just put a little bit each day. It was absolutely astonishing. The first month they came, all the women came dancing down the aisle, you know, with their buckets on their heads, dancing to the music, and they started pouring the grain in the front of the church, and it was absolutely amazing, the amount of grain that they had collected. And now they had a way of helping the widows and helping the orphans from their own resources. They didn't have to go to USAID. They didn't have to go to the federal government. They didn't have to go to World Health. From among themselves, they had plenty of grain to help the widows in their congregation. So that began the Widows Bucket Program. This began to grow and grow. And finally, Dorothy realized that there was no way we could reach all 5,000 churches in the Equa group that we work with. So she began going to women's fellowship meetings. So they have annual meetings where they get 5,000 or 10,000 women together and they have their annual spiritual life conference. So then we began distributing buckets 5,000 at a time. Okay? So that program has continued to grow and to grow. And I think the latest number that we've come up with is 125,000 buckets now we've been able to distribute to women in women's fellowships all over northern Nigeria. And some of those, most of those churches that we went to initially are still collecting the grains. Dorothy was at a women's fellowship meeting 3 weeks ago, and she went in, and a woman brought her grain in, and on the bucket was a sticker for 2004. So 8 years she's been bringing grain every month to help the widows in the church. Well, some of these churches said to Dorothy, you know, we don't have that many widows. What do we do with all this grain? So she said, well, you know what? Why don't you go into the community and just knock on doors and see where the other widows are who don't go to your church. Some of them may be Christians, some of them may be Muslims, some of them may be whatever. And say, you know what, we're from the church down the road and we'd like to help you. Wow, what a way to help. And it opened up phenomenal doors of witness and opportunity to show that they cared about the people in their community. So the Widow's Grain Bucket Project has continued to grow, and we're excited that the Lord has continued to use that to touch in a very tangible way women and children that have real need. With the buckets, we've also included several pieces of literature to try to provide some AIDS education. And so not only do the widows learn about Christ through the counseling and the contact they have through basic evangelism, but they also learn about AIDS. And they learn how to tell their kids about sexuality and how to tell their kids about AIDS. And so that program has also grown. So we're providing education, providing a tangible way to support the widows and the orphans. And it doesn't cost anything except the 50 cents for the cost of the bucket. So it's a wonderful program, again, that you guys have been a part of and the Lord has continued to bless. And now it's, again, run by nationals, run by Nigerians. We left a Nigerian fellow in charge of the whole program, and he does a fantastic job in organizing the distribution of the buckets and getting the literature and training everybody that goes there. So that's the Widow's Bucket Project. And again, thank you for your part in making that possible. Let me close in the next 3 minutes and tell you a little bit about Hillcrest, because that's where Dorothy has spent the last several years, and my children have been there, and I've been involved in a variety of capacities. Hillcrest School is a school for missionaries' children. It has a lot of other kids there, but it's primarily for missionaries' children and has been there since the 40s and is a wonderful place to provide a good quality education for our kids. Some people think that if you're not church planting, you're not a real missionary. Let me say that again. Some people think that if you're not church planting, right, you're not a real missionary. Well, let me just tell you, I've had people come up to me as a surgeon and say, you're not a real missionary either, because you're not planting churches. So I usually respond by, well, the next time you need your appendix out, don't come looking for me. Okay? We have found that actually many, many families that are working on the mission field wouldn't be able to be there if it wasn't for a facility like Hillcrest that allows them to provide a good education for their kids. Lots of missionaries homeschool their kids, and that's a wonderful option for many families. But for some families, it's not the best option. And so Hillcrest has been a place where Dorothy's been involved as a teacher for 2 years, and then the last 2 years, she's been the principal of the elementary school and has done a phenomenal job as an administrator and mentoring young teachers and helping with the initiation of a character development program and all kinds of fluency in reading and writing programs, and really trying to help establish at the elementary level the fundamentals of biblical principles and values. And it's been exciting to see the way the Lord has used that school. Kids that graduate from that school go on to become leaders around the world. When we look at our alumni from the school, it is absolutely amazing to see where they are in positions in high levels of government, in corporations around the world. Many have gone back into missions and have been leaders throughout the world. So it's been really exciting. I've been involved more at a committee level and a board level. I also teach Bible. I teach apologetics and biblical ethics in the school at the high school level. And it's been great for us to see kids grow in their faith and grow in their understanding. I don't know if you've heard the statistic, but Dobson and his group would say that 85% of Christian high school kids from Christian homes who go to college walk away from the church and walk away from their faith. 85%. Pretty staggering and pretty discouraging, which means that many Christian young people are not learning how to defend their faith and aren't learning the reasons why the Christian faith is true. And when they get to college and they're assaulted with secularism and all kinds of views that attack Christianity, they don't know what to say. And they can't defend their faith and they cave. And they end up walking away from the faith that their parents had raised them in. And so it's been exciting for me at Hillcrest to have a small part in trying to help establish in young people the basis for their faith. What is our apologetic? What is the basic defense of the faith? Why do we believe Christianity is true? And then how does that apply in real life situations in biblical ethics, in terms of sexual issues, homosexuality, in terms of bioethical issues, reproductive technology and cloning, in terms of all kinds of issues in the world today? How does our faith apply? Because if young people go to college and they don't have answers as Christians, they're going to be overwhelmed. I'm just telling you, they're going to sink. So that's one of the things that we're excited about in Christian education. I know you all are very strong supporters of Christian education. So let me close because time's up and just say again, thank you for your prayers and your encouragement and your support over the many years that we've been in Africa. We leave thankful for the opportunity to see some fruit from our labor. We know the Lord is doing all kinds of things that we can't see, but we're grateful that we were blessed with many people that were friends that we saw growing in their walk with God and growing in their relationship and using their gifts in all kinds of wonderful ways. So we're really grateful for that. We appreciate your prayers through the summer as we travel across the states. We'll be driving from here to upstate New York and then all the way across the states over the course of the summer, and won't get back to California until the middle of August. So we've got about 5,000 miles of driving ahead of us this summer, and we appreciate your prayers as we visit friends and churches and again thank them for all they've done for us. And then as we go through this adjustment in our own lives and saying, well, how does the Lord want to use us while we're here in the States? How can we get plugged in into ministries and whatever he has for us in California? We're not sure. The girls will be in college and they're excited about that big change, but they also face a big adjustment going into schools here in the States. So pray for them too. And then David, as he adjusts to middle school in California, it's going to be a big change for him. So we appreciate your prayers. And again, thank you for the opportunity to share. I'll share with you my life verse that has been, I think has helped me through all kinds of situations. It's a very simple verse from Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he'll direct your paths. You know, we went to Africa thinking that we would do one thing, and God has redirected our paths many, many times. And he has asked us to trust him through all those changes and to trust him through all those stresses. And so my encouragement to you is to learn to trust the Lord in such a way that you can abandon yourself to his will and allow him to direct you. And you'll be surprised sometimes the direction that he leads you. So thanks again and appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you for listening to this teaching from Bay Ridge Christian Church. To learn more about our church or to download more teachings and resources, please visit bayridgechristianchurch.org.